Tonight, we take on one of the most uncomfortable and necessary conversations in Washington. Who is holding members of Congress accountable? Recent accusations involving lawmakers, renewed scrutiny of past misconduct claims, and questions about taxpayer-funded settlements have once again put Capitol Hill under the microscope. I'm Scotty Nell Hughes, and this is America First. Trust in Congress is already low. And one major reason is simple. Americans suspect that when ordinary people break the rules, the consequences are swift. But when political power is involved, the system protects itself. For years, allegations involving members of Congress were often handled through internal compliance offices, settlements, confidential agreements, and opaque procedures unfamiliar to the public. Taxpayer money was at times tied to settlement structures involving workplace misconduct claims. And when reformers pushed for sunlight on which offices were involved, how much was paid, and who knew what, resistance followed. Why? Well, because transparency creates accountability, and accountability threatens institutions built on mutual protection. See, this is not a partisan problem. Both parties have had members accused of misconduct. Both parties have defended allies. Both parties have condemned their opponents. But too often, both parties have preferred selective outrage over systematic reform. Now let's add in another factor, public frustration over this elite impunity in the wake of years of unanswered questions involving Epstein, associates, their enablers, and the broader culture of privilege that seems insulated from consequences. Now many Americans are asking whether Washington only acts when exposure becomes unavoidable. So tonight, we're going to discuss whether Congress can police itself or whether outside pressure is the only thing that actually works. Names in the headlines include Eric Swalwell, Tony Gonzalez, but this conversation is actually far better, bigger than any one Republican or any Democrat, because tonight's real issue is systemic. For years, Americans have asked whether members of Congress operate under a whole different set of rules than people that they represent. There have been reports of confidential settlements, non-disclosure mechanisms, and internal compliance systems, and repeated resistance to make public which offices were tied to misconduct claims. So why was transparency resisted? Why were efforts to reveal which offices benefited from secrecy voted down? And perhaps most importantly, why is so much of this surfacing now, after years of public distrust fueled by unanswered questions surrounding powerful figures connected to the Jeffrey Epstein network? So tonight, we ask whether Washington is finally confronting accountability or simply managing another scandal news cycle. So joining me tonight, Angie Wong, conservative strategist and Florida GOP committee woman. Michael Flynn, Houston attorney and former U.S. assistant attorney at the Department of Justice. Thank you so much, Michael and Angie, for being here with me tonight on this subject.
Thank you.
I
want to start with this broadest issue. Specific names may dominate these headlines for a few days, but the public concern, I do believe, is really deeper. And whether Congress has built this internal system that shields these members from scrutiny. So, Angie, is the real scandal individual allegations or a culture on Capitol Hill where lawmakers believe rules don't apply equally to them?
Yeah, anyone who's worked on the Hill or covered the Hill, they've known that this has gone on for decades and mainly unchecked, because congressional members do have immunity. They know that if there is misconduct, that their party leaders will protect them. And it's been an awful cycle that's been going on for a very long time, so much so that even party leaders will use this to their advantage. I'm not saying blackmail, but there's a lot of times that votes are whipped this way, and I've seen it firsthand. So they didn't want to let that go because it was such a great strangle on some of these congressional members to get them voting a certain way. I'm just so happy that the story has legs, that everything is getting exposed, so much so that just recently Congress has put out a report on 28 congressional members that have been investigated for sexual misconduct. And now we're learning about the payments that taxpayers were putting out. We're talking about over $450,000 of taxpayer funds going to paying off some of these victims and legal fees, et cetera. I want to learn all about them only so that this never happens again and the congressional members do not have pure immunity.
Well, to Angie's point, Michael, you know, these Americans were outraged when they learned that misconduct claims connected to congressional workplaces could involve confidential settlements. I mean, you didn't think that was even possible. And historically, public resources in the process. I want to ask you from the legal and ethical standpoint, should members of Congress ever receive privacy protection beyond what ordinary employers and employees receive?
Absolutely not. I want to add, I agree with Angie, plus I'm also concerned with the national security angle of all of this and the institutional structure and the incentives that are put in place where representatives are more concerned about themselves, preserving their districts, preserving their jobs. In many instances, they don't know how else to contribute to the economy, don't know what else to do, and so they hold on to these jobs. Now, what I'm in favor of is institutional term limits and some type of security clearance required members of Congress, their political staffs at home and in Washington, and even heightened security for those who are entrusted with membership on some of these intelligence committees. You know, as an assistant U.S. attorney and in many positions, you have to go through a extreme vetting security process. You don't have that with Congress. You need to have it, and they have access to a whole lot more than your line prosecutor does. You know, I think we do that, we're going to see limits and term limits.
But that's term limit. People would, and I agree, there's a national call right now for term limits. And by golly, if you're a person running for office, you are saying that you want term limits. But Michael, I got to stay on the subject you brought about security clearance. People would push back. Their people, their constituents chose them. Is that not security clearance enough for them?
Absolutely not. You know, absolutely not. You know, your average citizen is simply not going to know sufficient detail about the individual that they're voting for. In many instances, they're not even going to know the person. They will have seen, you know, who has the most yard signs up out there. Mm-hmm. No, we need real security clearance, looking into backgrounds, looking into history. You know, look at that guy from New York. Was it George Sanchez Lopez who got elected with all those lies that we're told? I mean, that's Exhibit A for some type of clearance review.
That's a really good point. And Angie, I've got to bring you into this because one of the most frustrating parts, I believe, for voters has been this effort to block and dilute these disclosures to which these offices were tied to. You know, why would any lawmaker actually oppose transparency if they knew their security clearance was even being questioned? Why would they want reform? Is it privacy, due process, or do you think just self-preservation?
Well, I agree with Michael. I mean, we should start at the campaign level, vetting these candidates going in. I think Michael was alluding to George Santos, who is from the district I lived in when I was living in New York. He should never have been even a candidate on the ballot, given his background and all the things that he would have broken through just a regular security check. So I agree, we have to stop it from there. But, you know, going forward, you get into all these private meetings and these committees while you're up on the Hill. You're making decisions for Americans and for our U.S. markets based on your security clearance. And now we're learning that they may be compromised given all the extracurricular activities they're doing. So I think that, you know, transparency has to be there. But what congressional makeup is going to push for this? Because everyone has a push-pull on this. Everyone has their advantage of, you know, having their committee assignments and things like that. So I do hope that, you know, this effort to bring on transparency, especially to some of the sexual allegations that we're talking about here, does have some form of reform that, you know, will be a result of these investigations.
You know, Michael, you bring up a really good point that I don't think anybody's asked before, and I don't even know if it would be legal, but could we not ask for congressional candidates to go through a background check and issue what level of security based on what they reveal, what's been revealed about them? Could we even legally do that as a country? I know they do it to go into the White House administration. Why have we not made that potentially a law that you have to pass a background check to run for Congress, and we know what kind of level of security clearance that you potentially could have?
You know, it'd be interesting for a senator or a congressman to introduce such a bill in both houses, and let's see who votes against it, to establish some type of oversight office, to conduct this kind of review. Of course, it could be part of our election code in a minute. I think that's the way to do it rather than have it imposed by the executive or the judiciary. Let's set it up within Congress, see who votes against it. That'll tell us something.
I think that would also help in a lot of this opposition research that you would have, even as you go into state offices. Because if you go in and say, obviously, if you can pass a security clearance, they'll give you a high issue, a high level security, you'd be available to take. Who cares about any opposition research that they put out about you? Then we could actually maybe have clean campaigns based on policy. But Angie, I'm going in a whole new route. I do want to talk about these members that have been accused of misconduct over the years. Why does Washington continue to treat accountability as this partisan weapon? And what does that do to actually getting real truth out there and actually solutions to keeping this from happening to future staff members?
Oh, because the numbers are so tight, Scotty. You have barely like single digits on both sides, right? So if you lose one member from one side, they go after the other side. Look at what's happening. Eric Swalwell, Corey Mills, want an eye for an eye is what they're doing because they can't lose those numbers. They both have to win somehow, pass some of these bills, and their margins are so, so tight. So that's what's happening here. It's still pure politics. It's not about the victims. It's not about the misconduct. It really is whether or not policies can be passed.
And let me just point out some of these names that are on the list that was just released, like Angie referenced to. They're saying that it was part of staff members within that congressional office. It wasn't necessarily the congressman or senator's name that was listed. It could have been something going on by one of their staff members as well, and yet it fell underneath that umbrella. Hence why a lot of these congressmen voted against transparency, because they did not feel like it was right to make those names be known since it wasn't their own. Angie, Michael, we're going to have to continue this conversation because it is such intricate that I don't think it's going to go away unless we start putting out some real solutions. Stay right there. Because when we come back, we're going to discuss timing. Why is all of this actually resurfacing right now? Do you believe this to be a coincidence? Is it factional warfare, media pressure, or public anger after years of elite scandals, including this unresolved Epstein-related questions? More when America First returns. Welcome back to America First. I'm Scotty Nell Hughes. Tonight, we're discussing misconduct allegations, congressional secrecy, and whether Capitol Hill is finally being forced to answer to the American people. Still with us are Angie Wong and Michael Nguyen. And before this break, we were actually having a really good conversation about the system of protection and the failure of transparency. Now, I've got to talk about timing. I always talk about timing because this harassment, these types of settlements are nothing new on Capitol Hill. But Angie, many Americans are asking a very fair question. Why now? Why are these stories about misconduct, settlements, and insider protection surfacing at this moment after years of silence? Let's look at Eric Swalwell running for governor, and yet all these accusations go on for years. Do you believe this is genuine accountability? Or is this actually more a story about political convenience?
I think that's a little bit of both. In fact, I think, you know, Congress now is having their Me Too moment, right? And every industry will go through this, but now it's settling on the Hill. And I'm just happy that it's happening because it's gone on for so long under the table. Everyone pretty much knows about something or someone who's been involved in something like this, but now it's really coming kind of in favor, in fashion. But I think a lot of it is brought on because Eric Swalwell did decide to be so hubris to run for California governor. And you have other congressional candidates, gubernatorial candidates, that think, oh, this, I'm going to be Teflon. I'm political Teflon here. Nothing, you know, can touch me. I'm going to run for higher office. And we're saying, actually, no, because, you know, if these allegations prove to be true, they could actually be criminal charges, right? So I think that the investigations have to happen, the process has to go through itself, but also let's discover who's been enabling them, who's protecting them. That's where these investigations should go, because it wasn't just one person.
Well, and I hate to go back to the previous segment, but Michael, Angie brings up a good point. You talked about security clearance. We're talking about Eric Swalwell right now. It doesn't seem to be this kind of outcry even from Democrats, but especially Republicans, when he was supposedly sleeping and sharing secrets with a Chinese spy. Nobody was calling for his head at this point. Why now? Do you think this is just political convenience in the case of like Eric Swalwell being asked to step down by people like Nancy Pelosi?
Well, I think it's two matters. Political expediency, of course, at least here in Texas, we have runoffs and several contested matters coming up here in about a month. And then the midterm elections, obviously, you know, this is the time to try to get every advantage you possibly can. And so I think that accounts for the timing. The other thing is, you know, candidates and this opposition research, everybody has limited resources. So you're going to devote your limited resources to whoever seems to bubble up on the other side. And so that's probably why the Swalwell thing may have run under the radar for so long. You know, when they try to step up a little bit, everybody's going to scrutinize everything they've ever done in the past. Just don't have enough resources otherwise.
Well, but then we talk about, we're looking at congressional candidates right now, but let's also talk about the recent scandal that's come out with Kristi Noem and her husband. It ultimately came out a week after she stepped down, talking about her husband and his fetish that he might have for wearing women's clothes. I got to ask you, Angie, on this side of opposition research, does things like this, does that not also compromise our former DHS secretary if she knew that was what his lifestyle was like, or that he was having multiple affairs on her? Could she have been put in a very bad position with other countries with that information?
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of that was suppressed. That information was actually known by the party for quite some time. And here's what I'm seeing over and over again. All of that is protected until that particular candidate or that person in power is no longer needed by the party and they become a liability to the party. That's when it's being used against her or him in this case. Look, I have a feeling that all of these pictures, they're all in a secret file. They pull them out when it's necessary. So when Eric Swalwell became a liability to the Democratic Party and the California races, he had to go, and he had to go now. That's why they used these images against them when they needed it.
This reminds me, Michael, of another case that's hitting headlines, or it's not headlines lately, but I know people still have a lot of questions, at least if you're outside of Washington, D.C. Epstein wasn't just about one man. It was also about the perception that powerful networks receive different treatments and this idea of a little bit of extortion that we saw, or possibly manipulating political people to make decisions based on the information they had on them. Has this broader frustration about the lack of information, the full disclosure of what's all in Epstein files, do you think that's changed the public's tolerance for secrecy involving elected officials?
I think it has, but also even more in that example is kind of the inconsistent, uncertain, and what I saw is a lack of confidence on the part of our otherwise, you know, great former attorney general. You got to put forth the image that the disclosure of confidential information or whatever, everything that's in the Epstein file is being reviewed in a systematic fashion would have given the public a lot more confidence in it. Not going back and forth and back and forth. Show that you got some criteria, you're applying the criteria, and the public will be patient. That's the way you got to do it.
Or empty binders, taking a bunch of influencers and giving them empty binders and saying, we've seen it, when there was nothing in there.
That destroys everything. That destroys everything.
It's all about the credibility. And so, Michael, while I have you, I have to ask you, since you're from our legal mind, if Congress were serious about these reforms tomorrow, what would that actually look like? Would there be mandatory disclosures of personal situations, independent investigational, personal liability instead of taxpayer exposure? What actually would be the legal approach to this?
Okay. Just like we do with any background check, the Department of Justice, someone's applying for clearance, you list every address you've had in the past perhaps 10 years, medical records, including look at controlled substance abuse, verify that, have individuals, you've got to name individuals that you've known, any prior employment, any prior resident, and then have follow-up, somebody anonymous follow-up to find out and verify the truth of those matters. School records, all those background things, someone's biography. Not too difficult. Let's propose the bill with oversight by the judicial branch, not by Congress itself. Can't have the fox watching the hen house.
That is a great line right there. And I have to say, Angie, for voters who are watching tonight who feel like neither party actually cleaned its own house, what should they demand in 2026 and beyond?
Well, they should be cleaning their own houses. I think everyone's eyes are on these stories right now, and every candidate will be put through the same scrutiny come the 2026 and 28 election. So I think all of this has to be put out there. And I agree with everyone on this panel. I think that, you know, full transparency has to happen, but who is going to enforce these transparencies? I don't know how this is working. I like what Michael has said. We do need some sort of judicial review of all of this as well. But for voters, you know, this is going to be a hot topic for the midterm elections. And whoever comes off more authentic and more protective, especially of some of the women and younger staff members who are often the victims here, that's what I want to hear from. I want to hear real ideas for protecting them.
Well, I want to thank you. Michael Wynn, it's our first conversation we've had together. Absolutely enjoyed it. Angie Wong, you've been a longtime friend of the show. Thank you so much for joining me in this conversation. I doubt this will be the last time that we're discussing this issue, but I hope to have you back on.
Thank you very much. Take care.
See, this issue, it's bigger than just gossip, bigger than one's accusation. It's bigger than one party. It is about whether self-government can survive when citizens believe the governing class protects itself first. You know, no private employee should fund settlements for a boss's misconduct. Let me read that again. No private employee should fund settlements for a boss's misconduct. I don't care if you're in the private sector or the government sector. No institution should hide wrongdoing behind procedure, and no party should excuse its own side while condemning the other. If lawmakers actually want public trust, the formula is simple. Tell the truth. Release the records allowed by law. Create independent oversight and live under the same standard as the people who sent you there. Because when Congress demands accountability from America but refuses it for itself, voters notice. Eventually, the voters will respond. My thanks tonight goes to Angie Wong and Michael Wynn for a candid and very important conversation that I hope continues until we have accountability and, most importantly, solutions. Thank you for watching. I'm Sky Nell Hughes, and this has been America First. Good night.